Were the feds trying to recover nuclear documents from Donald Trump's Florida estate?
How the FBI's search of Mar-a-Lago cannot escape the divided politics here.
Plus, the effort to slow down those rent hikes in one Florida county.
This is the Florida Roundup. From WLRN Public Media in Miami and WJCT Public Media in Jacksonville, I'm Tom Hudson.
And I'm Melissa Ross. Well, this hour, the U.S. Attorney General personally signed off on the warrant to search former President Trump's estate in Palm Beach. Why did a Florida magistrate okay that FBI move? Plus, Orlando area voters will get to decide if rent increases should be capped.
You can join our conversation statewide, 305-995-1800. Across the peninsula and panhandle, across the political spectrum, the same phone number, 305-995-1800.
Washington. I'm Windsor Johnston. Author Salman Rushdie has been attacked at a literary festival in western New York. Rushdie, whose writing led to death threats in the 1980s, was preparing to give a lecture today. The Associated Press reports a man stormed the stage at an education center near Buffalo and began punching or stabbing Rushdie as he was being introduced. Former President Donald Trump says he does not oppose the release of documents related to the FBI search of his Florida estate this week. NPR's Ryan Lucas reports this comes after the Justice Department asked a federal court to unseal the details of the warrant used to search his residence.
Attorney General Merrick Garland has said the Justice Department is seeking to make public the search warrant and the property receipt from the Mar-a-Lago search this week. In its filing before a federal court, the department left space for Trump to object. Last night, Trump said on his social media platform that he does not oppose the move and that he encourages the document's immediate release. Trump's attorneys were given copies of both the warrant and the inventory at the time of the search, and Trump could have made them public at any time, but chose not to. Instead, he's lashed out at the department over the search. Ryan Lucas, NPR News, Washington.
The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is relaxing some of its COVID-19 guidelines. The CDC no longer recommending that people only exposed to the virus quarantine. NPR's Ping Wong reports the agency says most Americans now have some protection.
95% of people in the U.S. have either gotten vaccinated or have recovered from COVID or both. Still, we know that doesn't mean you can't catch the virus, just hopefully that you'll have a mild case. So Massetti said that there's booster shots, antivirals, special shots for the immunocompromised. There are several layers out there that can help stop many people from getting hospitalized or dying from COVID.
That's NPR's Ping Wang reporting. A shipment of Ukrainian grain is set to be loaded today for delivery to Ethiopia to help ease a severe food shortage in that country. NPR's Joanna Kakissis has more.
Infrastructure Minister Oleksandr Kubrakov wrote on Facebook that a container ship called the Brave Commander is set to deliver 23,000 tons of grain to Ethiopia. The UN negotiated the wartime deal to export Ukrainian grain and cooking oil by sea to help address global food shortages and rising prices. Turkey's defense ministry also said two more ships have departed Ukrainian ports loaded with grain. The Star Laura is shipping more than 60,000 tons of corn to Iran, while the Sormovsky 121 is sending about 3,000 tons of wheat to Turkey. Joanna Kakissis, NPR News, Uman, Ukraine.
You're listening to NPR News in Washington. Forecasters in Europe are warning of record drought conditions. Officials are reporting a significant reduction in water levels for major rivers, including the Rhine and Danube. The dry conditions are also helping to fuel wildfires that are burning in several countries, including a massive blaze in southwestern France. The South Korean government has pardoned the heads of two top conglomerates, including electronics giant Samsung. NPR's Anthony Kuhn reports the president claims the pardons will be good for the nation's economy.
The pardoned executives, Lee Jae-yong and Shin Dong-bin, are respectively heads of Samsung and Lotte, South Korea's first and fifth largest family-run conglomerates. Both were sentenced to jail for bribing former President Park Geun-hye, who was ousted and jailed following mass protests 5 years ago. Current President Yoon Suk-yeol told a cabinet meeting Friday that he hoped the pardons would help pull the nation out of economic crisis. It's not the first time South Korean presidents have pardoned white-collar criminals. Lee Jae-yong's father was convicted twice for corruption and tax evasion and pardoned both times, the second time after paying the president additional bribes. Anthony Kuhn, NPR News, Seoul.
New Zealand is welcoming its first cruise ship since the start of the pandemic. The South Pacific island had closed its borders in early 2020 to control the spread of the virus. Stocks are trading higher across the board on Wall Street at this hour. The Dow was up 233 points. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include EBSCO, providing access to ebooks and research content on the go with the EBSCO mobile app. Information about EBSCO's commitment to research.
Support for the Florida Roundup comes from ABC Fine Wine and Spirits, family-owned and operated since 1936. Guests can shop any of ABC's 125 Florida stores and get curbside service through abcfws.com.
Welcome to the Florida Roundup here on Florida Public Radio. Thanks for listening this week. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. Well, this week began with the FBI showing up Monday morning to former President Donald Trump's home in Florida. They were acting on a search warrant approved by a federal magistrate in Palm Beach County. Now, this marked the first known time ever a search warrant has been executed against a former president of the United States. New reporting today indicates the feds may have been trying to recover classified nuclear documents.
By Tuesday, Trump supporters gathered at a bridge near his Mar-a-Lago estate. Adrian Schockett is a registered Republican, former Democrat. She believes the justice system treats elected Republican officials more harshly than Democrats, and she wanted more evidence about the raid.
Nobody knows. I mean, look, if they find something... Okay, I mean, I'm a Republican, but if they find something that's illegal or terribly wrong or whatever you want to call it, then justice needs to be served.
Della Stryker considers herself a staunch Republican who is often upset with the GOP because she believes many in her party have turned against Trump.
Came here last night because I was so grieved what I heard, and I just got in the car and drove, and I met a stranger, never met her before. She was at a Trump flag, and went over to her, we embraced, and we wept for the state of the nation, that they would take a president and go raid his safe.
Now, by Thursday afternoon, Attorney General Merrick Garland confirmed that he signed off on requesting the warrant and filed a court motion to make the search warrant public. Thursday night, the former president called for the documents to be unsealed immediately.
Meanwhile, new reporting today in the Washington Post indicates federal authorities were looking for unsecured classified nuclear documents at Mar-a-Lago in the interest of national security. Coming up later here on the Florida Roundup, we'll talk about the politics of all this, including responses from Florida's two Republican senators and your calls. What are your thoughts about this extraordinary news here in Florida? Join us, 305-995-1800. Tweet the show, at Florida Roundup.
Your phone calls and tweets coming up in a few moments. But first, what led up to this unprecedented action happening in a federal court in Florida with the search warrant happening on Palm Beach Island? Antonio Finns is politics and growth editor of the Palm Beach Post and USA Today Florida Network, back with us here on the Roundup. Antonio, quite a week, and news continues to break even today on this Friday. It's been a week now since this search warrant was issued. We learned that it was issued on Friday a week ago. What have we learned about the process that led up to it?
Well, we're still learning about the process that led up to it. But, you know, this is not something that just happened out of a vacuum. This is something that has been percolating for more than a year. Their first revelations back part of last year that Mr. Trump had kept about 15 boxes of documents in violation, apparent violation of the Presidential Records Act, which makes all presidential records, papers, and documents public record that have to be turned over to the National Archives after a presidency ends. And then we find out, we have not confirmed this independently, but it's been out there, and Attorney General Garland referenced it yesterday. At some point earlier this year, there was a subpoena issued for another selection of documents. And in fact, we hear that they took about, they found about 12 boxes of documents in this search and seizure on Monday. And look, I've done research at the National Archives, the Archives Annex in Maryland, and five presidential libraries. I can tell you, you know, 27 boxes of documents. You can basically write a book about that. That's a lot of documents. Yeah. And, you know, so we got to find out more. And we've been at this for a week, and I think we're going to be at this for a lot longer because there's going to be a lot more to come.
We'll talk more about that process here. But what questions would be answered if this search warrant is made public? And, you know, the details matter when it comes to these kind of court proceedings. When calling for the release of a search warrant, what specifically, what explicitly could be made public?
Well, here's the thing. Generally speaking, okay, we've never had a search warrant for a former president's home. And in fact, I spoke to Jill Winebanks, who was a former Watergate prosecutor, and she said that no, they during the Watergate, right, that month between the resignation of Richard Nixon and the pardon, they never actually thought about a search of the San Clemente home where Mr. Nixon was living at. So this is completely unprecedented. But generally speaking, a search warrant tells you what they're looking for, where they're looking for it, and perhaps even the probable cause, the underlying suspected crime that has been committed. We don't know if this search warrant will offer all that, particularly if we're talking about highly classified materials they're looking for. They're not going to tell us because otherwise that breaks the secrecy. So I think we're all right now on search warrant watch to see when this is released. But I would caution that there may not be as many answers as we hope there would be, but we'll see.
How special was this process for the search warrant, given that it was targeting a former president of the United States, certainly a former commander-in-chief of the United States Armed Forces, former leader of the free world, and it's a local federal magistrate whose signature appears on this search warrant, presumably?
Yeah, but Attorney General Garland made it very clear yesterday afternoon that he signed off on this. That's how special this was. This went through every possible lever of government, with the exception of the White House, which denied that they knew anything about it. And for political reasons, they probably would be better to have been kept in the dark. But I think in this case, the Attorney General referenced yesterday, the allusion to less intrusive, as he called it, measures that were used initially, which suggests to us that that was the subpoena. We also believe that, you know, when they arrived on Monday morning, that they were actually escorted in by the Secret Service, that they knew they were coming in. So this idea that, you know, that we hear so often when the secret, you know, when they show up to execute a search warrant, that they knock on the door and you stand in your driveway and you're sleeping pajamas. That's right. Not what happened here. Mr. Trump wasn't even on the property at the time. So it was a very special case all around.
The U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of Florida signed the motion to unseal the search warrant. Any significance that it was the Southern District of Florida assistant attorney signing this appeal or signing this request?
I'm not sure, since it's all happening here, that would make sense. I think the more interesting thing is going to be this discussion that apparently is supposed to take place today between the Justice Department lawyers, the lawyers for Mr. Trump, about the release of this document. This is very unusual, you know, that the DOJ turns around 4 days after a search and seizure and says, okay, let's make the documentation public. The other question is how much of that documentation is made public. The Palm Beach Post and many other media organizations have asked for the entire cache of documents around this. I think that what the DOJ is saying that they would like to see released is not the complete set, but we'll find out.
Make that difference, Antonio, in terms of the search warrant itself and the complete cache of documents that may have been seized in this search that media organizations such as yours, the Palm Beach Post, are asking for.
Yeah, it's a full set of documents. And again, this is unprecedented. So we don't really know what the full range is. That's something that it will have to be discussed in court when this is heard, when the motion by the Palm Beach Post and the other news organizations is debated. But I think that we're trying to get as much as we can. Of particular interest is anything, any documentation that speaks to an underlying crime. And there may not have been. They may have just shown up to take these documents and give them to the National Archives. So there may not have been a crime here at all, but that's one thing we'd be looking for. And then, you know, if there is a detailed list of what was taken and from where, that would be another one. The other question is, Mr. Trump has talked about on his Truth Social app, mm-hmm. that, you know, in fact, yesterday he posted that they even went through former First Lady Melania Trump's closet and rummaged through her personal items. Well, where did they search precisely? So there is a lot that we'd like to see. I don't know how much is in those documents. That's way above my pay grade.
Yeah.
But, you know, but I'm like everybody else, can't wait to see what we can get and when.
It may answer how extensive the magistrate allowed the FBI agents to look throughout the property, how open the search was or how targeted the search was, if specific rooms or locations were identified, were being requested to be searched, or if it was something that was perhaps more universal. The property, Mar-a-Lago, has been the source of security concerns in the past during the Trump administration. Remind us of some of those.
Yeah, but to your previous point, you actually raised a really important point that the property is two sets of property. There is the residence where the former president and former first lady live when they're here. Mm-hmm. And then there is the club, the for-profit private club for members. So the question is, did they just search the residence or did they actually go in and search the club? We don't know. But to go to this has been the Trump presidency here was unique and completely unprecedented in that you had a president of the United States spending time at a property that was both private residence and for business private club. You know, when George W. Bush went to the ranch in Crawford, that was just a ranch out of the way that was his residence. Same thing when, you know, Jimmy Carter went to Plains, Georgia. He went to a home, or when Joe Biden goes to his home in Delaware, it's a residence that is insecure. This is different. And through the years, there were a number of instances that raised a lot of concerns among national security analysts. The first one was in February of 2017, a North Korea missile test. Trump is having dinner with the late Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe when the news comes in. And they have kind of like a situation room meeting in this dining club in front of all the club members and their guests. Then there was the two arrests of Chinese nationals, one who had all kinds of surveillance equipment in her hotel room, another one that was taking photographs. We don't know what they were up to, but and then there was the case where a vehicle sped through the security checkpoints and Secret Service agents and police opened fire. Thankfully, no one was hurt, but it all spoke, and it didn't seem there was anything that we could ever find out that was nefarious about any of that, but it all spoke to the fact that this was a heightened security alert, that there was hypersensitive about the security risk in a location that, although it is walled off, was accessible to a lot of people other than the family and the closest friends, because it was a private for business club.
And as we speak with Antonio Finns of the Palm Beach Post, give us a call here on the Florida Roundup as we discuss the massive news that happened right here in Florida this week, as former President Trump's home at Mar-a-Lago in Palm Beach was subject to an FBI search. 305-995-1800. Tweet us at Florida Roundup. Let's go to Warren in Delray. Hi, Warren. Thanks for holding. You're on the air.
Pardon me. Thank you very much for allowing me to participate. Of course, the search was proper. It went through the proper channels. Those documents, I've heard it right here on this station. Would your people lie? Those things belong to the National Archives. They're carrying... We've reached a terrible juncture here in America. If the Republican candidate wins the election, he's won the election. If he loses the election, it was a stolen election. If the Republican ex-president is under suspicion of a crime, if you investigate, you're a dirty, rotten, horrible lefty and all that stuff. I must tell you before I go that a state court judge authorized my homeowners association to break into my apartment to do mold and electrical and plumbing inspections, and according to Florida state law, they're not allowed to do them.
Yep, we lost you there, Warren, but thank you for the call. Let's go back to Antonio Finns. Antonio, we'll get more into the politics of this in the next segment that he referred to, but you've been discussing this with Tom. It is against the law for a private citizen to hang on to these documents. The National Archives has been trying for some time to get them back. Can you talk a little bit more about what the law says when it comes to the handling of these types of sensitive documents?
Okay, yeah, the history of the law is it came out of Watergate. Before then, presidents kept their papers, their documents, and they could do whatever they wanted with them. Abraham Lincoln's family afterwards destroyed them. Ulysses S. Grant sold them. But after Watergate, because Watergate dealt with the criminal matter, and the Watergate prosecutors and even the Ford White House wanted to make sure that all those documents were preserved, there was a series of events that ended up with the 1978 Presidential Records Act, which basically says, it's very clear, you're the president, you get access, these are your documents, but the minute your term ends, they are now they're the public's domain, and they go to the National Archives. Now, you may have heard Mr. Trump now saying, well, what happened to the 33 million pieces of documents that, you know, Barack Obama took from him? Well, that's a separate matter. That's governed by, those documents are still in the hands of the National Archives. What they do is that for presidential libraries and for presidential research centers, whether it's Barack Obama, George W. Bush, Ronald Reagan, again, I've done research at five of those presidential libraries. All of that is still administered and governed by the National Archives. You need a National Archives researcher's pass to even go in and do research, and it is really restrictive. I mean, when you walk in, you can't take any papers. You can only take notes on paper they give you, and then when you walk out, they separate the papers and make sure you're not stealing documents. These documents are still all in the possession of the National Archives. And by the way, Mr. Warren made a good point in that, you know, talking about his condo being raided. Well, you know what? One of the talking points is, well, you know, if they do this to the president, they can do it to anybody. They do it to everybody. Every day in this country, in every state, the FBI shows up with a search warrant, some business, some individual. Some of those are approved, some are not. So that's kind of a specious argument as well.
Barbara in Miami. Hi, Barbara. What are your thoughts?
Well, hi. And on that note, they might do it for mold, but they certainly didn't do it for Clinton's emails or for Biden's laptop. And that's the problem. There is a definite
You're talking about Hunter Biden, I assume.
Of course. But yeah. Obviously, okay. There's implications there. I'm sorry. I know where the spin's going to go. But I know there's...
No, I appreciate the thought. We're very close to a break. Antonio, quickly, your response.
Let's hang up on me because you don't like what I have to say. Thank you.
Not at all. I want you to answer her question. Go ahead, Antonio.
No, let her finish. Yeah, look, I mean, the Clinton emails, there was an FBI investigation. They did. Then James Comey actually gave a presentation that at the time was unprecedented. They never talk about investigation. He came out and he made his statement. Now, you can agree with what he said or not, and that's still a matter for debate. It still is today. People are still debating whether a crime was committed or not, and whether she should have been charged. But there was an investigation. The Hunter Biden laptop, look, I'm sorry, I'm not as familiar with that. I watch Mar-a-Lago because it's down the street, so that's what we do, because it just happens to be here. And I don't think we've heard the last of that, by the way, the Hunter Biden laptop, because if...
He is being investigated, or his activities being investigated by the Justice Department.
There is a Justice Department investigation. Plus, the Republicans have said that if they were to take control of the House, they're going to launch investigations. And once the Justice Department reveals what they have, if there is a House investigation, we will report on that as well.
And I want to thank you, Antonia Finns, politics and growth editor at the Palm Beach Post. Thanks so much. A quick break, and when we come back, how is the news of the search at Mar-a-Lago playing among different voters? That's next.
Support for the Florida Roundup comes from ABC Fine Wine and Spirits, Florida family-owned and operated since 1936, and a proud supporter of public radio. ABC Fine Wine and Spirits. Always be celebrating.
Welcome back to the Florida Roundup. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville.
In Miami, I'm Tom Hudson. Reactions to the FBI search of former President Trump's home in Palm Beach came fast, and for top Republicans here in Florida, it was fury. This is Republican Senator Rick Scott Tuesday on Fox Business.
The way our federal government has gone, it's like what we thought about the Gestapo and people like that, that they just go after people. What we thought about Soviet Union, what we look at Latin America, we have got to say to ourselves, this cannot be our country. We have got to say, we're a country of laws, not of people that are attacking their political opponent and get away with it.
Governor Ron DeSantis called the FBI search, quote, another escalation in the weaponization of federal agencies. End quote. And he ended his tweet writing, Banana Republic. Republican Senator Marco Rubio appeared on Fox News Channel Tuesday night.
The next step in this process is going to be that people who are supporters of Donald Trump or just conservatives complaining about this are going to begin to get harassed by, are going to begin to get labeled as potential insurrectionists and are going to begin to get harassed by law enforcement. That's the next step in this playbook, sadly.
So let's get into it. How do voters view all of this? Through partisanship or legal process? It is an election year with ramifications for the next race for the White House in just 2 years and Florida's role in that next presidential election. 305-995-1800. Across the political spectrum, same phone number for everybody. NPA, Democrat, GOP, you name it. 305-995-1800. You can also hit us up on Twitter. Keep it civil there on social media, at Florida Roundup.
With more on the politics of all this, we welcome Democratic strategist Fernand Amandi and Republican strategist Adam Goodman here to the show. Hi, guys.
How are you?
Hey, pleasure to be here.
Good to have you both. Fernand Amandi, I want to start with you. What's your reaction to the comments we heard from Florida's two senators, Senator Scott and Senator Rubio, and also the governor's remarks?
Well, sadly, from my perspective, they are irresponsible comments at odds with everything that the great United States stands for. The one principle that you don't hear Senators Rubio or Scott discuss is that in the United States, no man or woman is above the law. And that applies to former presidents alike. And I think what we've seen take place here is further evidence of a Republican Party today that has gone far outside of the mainstream and really distanced itself, Melissa, from its origins as a law and order party in the defense of Donald Trump. This cult-like behavior where you see them attacking institutions now like the Justice Department and the FBI, not only does it hurt our institutions, it hurts America's image internally and abroad. And I think they're doing a grave disservice to the country with those irresponsible comments.
Adam Goodman, I'd like to get your response to that. Some Republicans have denounced the FBI. Some have threatened the agency on social media. What about that in light of new revelations today that the president was possibly improperly holding classified nuclear documents?
Well, we're certainly, Melissa, going to learn a lot in the coming days. But let's go and create a sense of context here, because what Tom said in the beginning of this segment is that partisanship or legal process that is driving opinions. Well, most Americans are not lawyers. They're not attorneys. They don't really understand the fine details of legal process. So obviously partisanship is what is fanning the flames of rhetoric and debate among all Americans right now over this FBI move. But the FBI itself, to give you context, you go back to 2018. I remember there was a poll done. Fernand is, I love Fernand. He's as a pollster, he'll appreciate. There's a poll done out of Penn State on the FBI. This is around the days of the controversies around former director Comey. And in that poll, it was determined that the majority of Republicans and independents in the country were very suspicious of the FBI in terms of its neutrality, like law and order only. And even 4 out of 10 Democrats had suspicions about it. And this is an FBI that you go way back, Melissa, you know, it used to have files on Elvis Presley and Frank Sinatra and John Denver. So there's that part of it.
Yeah, the J. Edgar Hoover days, I think you're kind of harkening back to.
Right, and J. Edgar Hoover. But and I'll just leave it with this. When you look at what happened the other night, or actually the other dawn, for FBI agents to show up unannounced, armed, in a quote-unquote pre-dawn raid to get records from the former president.
Well, technically it wasn't a raid. It was the execution of a legally obtained search warrant. But go ahead.
Okay. But in a pre-dawn move with FBI agents armed to get records at Mar-a-Lago, the appearances mean something. They count for something, especially when the FBI has not had what I call a clean bill of perceptional health over the last umpteen years. I think that was a very precipitous decision to do it in that fashion. And I think a lot of the reactions that you've heard are reflecting that.
Thank you for that, Adam. Fernand, let's talk about that for a moment. Partisanship and political divisions in this country have reached a state where agencies like the FBI, the Supreme Court, others have fallen prey to the lens of partisanship. You could perhaps make the argument that if the FBI had executed a search warrant on a former Democratic president, we'd see the same howls of outrage from Democrats. It's not a good state of affairs, though, for our national security, is it? That people are so distrustful of what federal authorities do in the interest, as reporting is indicating, in the interest of national security.
It's really not, Melissa. You can just imagine Vladimir Putin and America's enemies rubbing their hands with glee around the world as they watch this spectacle. And again, that speaks to why some of these comments are so irresponsible. Now, that doesn't mean that institutions, be it the FBI or the National Security Agency, or even the Central Intelligence Agency, they've engaged in egregious behavior. That's why we have oversight committees to look into that. But to simply question what on the books looks like a perfectly legally executed case, and again, not against a random, selectively persecuted individual here, Donald Trump is not someone who we shall we say, operates in the best of faith. I mean, he's been engaged in quasi-criminal behavior before the presidency, during the presidency, and in the post-presidency period. And I think the predicate that the Justice Department laid out here was a very clear one. Donald Trump was in possession, seemingly, of classified documents. There was a process to work out its return. That didn't happen. So in an abundance of caution, and we'll learn more as the details start to come out and trickle out in the next couple of days, they executed a lawful search where they notified not only Trump's legal counsel, but also the Secret Service assigned to protect President Trump. While it's no means something to celebrate, this is the sort of incident that you don't like to see talked about. It's not without cause, given the egregious quasi-criminal, if not criminal, behavior we've seen over Donald Trump since he assumed the presidency in 2017.
I agree with you that we certainly all do need to wait to learn more, and hopefully we will very soon. Let me ask you, Adam Goodman, let's talk about how this affects our governor in Florida, Ron DeSantis, who is widely assumed to be looking at a run for the presidency in 2024. This news out of Mar-a-Lago seems to have given former President Trump a real jolt of political momentum, and he could announce a 2024 presidential campaign sooner rather than later in response to this. What are your thoughts about that and how that affects Florida's Governor DeSantis?
Good question, Melissa. The short answer is yes, it could have an impact on former President Donald Trump's fortunes as a potential 2024 nominee. That could obviously not be in the interest of the governor if he were to pursue the same. But what the governor is focused on right now, which has made him such a possibility as a national figure for the Republican Party, is the Florida story. He's focused on, you know, kind of the positive aspects of what Florida has done over the last 2+ years. And I know, you know, let's take all the heat out of it for a second. Let's not be partisans. Let's be Floridians for a second and talk about the fact that in Florida, for the most part, on most measures, the state has done incredibly well. You have an immigration of another 300,000 people last year. It's one of the most popular places in the country for people to be moving to. You saw a recent ad from the governor of California talking about how freedom was under attack in Florida. Well, that's kind of rich coming from a state where there's been a record out-migration of people away from California to other parts of the country. And so the story itself, the Florida story, is very, very strong. His message, the governor's message, because of that, is very, very strong. And what he's also doing, and we saw, you might say, a harbinger of this, Melissa, last year in 2021 in Virginia, when now Governor Youngkin was running for election, I think that what Ron DeSantis represents is a growing of the Republican tent, that the Republican Party is no longer the party of big business, but the party of America's working class. You see that, this isn't rhetoric, you see this in the numbers. In registration alone, there's been a massive gain of Republican registration in Florida. They now have, for the first time, a majority of the registration over Democrats by 279,000 by last count. And the Democrats in Florida are starting to lose ground in favor of independents. Like, Democrats are moving independent. So whatever you want to argue rhetorically, the real numbers suggest that in Florida, people feel it's going very, very well on most measures, that if you had to live anywhere in the country, you look at where people have moved to in the last 3 years, Florida is like pretty much number one on the list. And I think that is the story that the governor has and has made him his topic of national conversation and speculation about his future.
Adam Goodman, a Republican strategist, is with us. So is Fernando Mondi, a Democratic strategist. We want to take your phone calls across the political spectrum. 305-995-1800 in St. Pete. Shady is listening in. Go ahead. You're on the radio.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. It's an honor to be here. As an American veteran and Florida resident, I know that we tend to bring in political parties, whether we're Democrat or Republican, into our law enforcement and into our military. But this is something our enemies would love to take advantage of, and something that every now and then we have to check ourselves. We're Americans first, and the political parties come later. But interesting of note, as a Floridian, I am independent. I can vote for Democrats. I can vote for Republicans. But I don't like to see law enforcement go into a former president's house unless you use certain network, certain protocols, because it also includes that classified documents can be leaked to people that they should not be leaked to. So in this regard, we just step back for a minute. I think your speakers mentioned it brilliantly. Let's put the partisan stuff to the side for a moment. And remember, we're Americans first, Floridians after, and God bless our country. Thank you for taking my call.
Appreciate that civil kind of attitude here on the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. Jim in Coral Springs, you have been waiting patiently. Go ahead, Jim. We want to hear from you.
First of all, yes, we are all Americans, but I do think that we also have been getting from both sides some tough stuff to believe. But ultimately, first of all, talked about that they went in armed. How many times does a FBI go in and unarmed for search warrants? So I'd like to get some idea on that. And then the search warrant wouldn't have happened if it wasn't supported. I mean, there has to be documents. There has to be stuff. So I think we're missing that. I'll take your comments off.
Sure, Jim. To that second point, certainly releasing the search warrant itself will answer a few questions, but it's really the kind of evidence that was offered up to the federal magistrate for probable cause that will perhaps give us even more light into what led the Department of Justice to request the search warrant. Adam Goodman, you had made the reference that the FBI agents were armed when they searched Mar-a-Lago. Why is that characterization important to you?
As I said before, Tom, I think appearances really count for something here. You've heard from my counterpart on the show, Fernand, that essentially he believes that the former president is a criminal and that this is all somehow deserved. But you also have to be awake and understand that this country is at the most divisive, sure, the Civil War, is at a more divisive point than ever in its history. We have people pitted against people, most of it because of the politicization of the process. And you talk about the Department of Justice, Tom. The Department of Justice, I think in most people's perception, is a legal arm of the party in power. It's a legal arm of the party in power. It's unfair.
Well, so that's perception, but is that reality in your estimation?
Well, I'm hoping that people, that's the perception for a lot of people, for too many people, Tom. I'm hopeful that because of the quality of people that have held the top posts in the Department of Justice, I think Merrick Garland, from all appearances, seems to have tried to have done everything he could to make this as normal and regular a part of the process as possible, short of the pre-dawn raid. I call it the pre-dawn raid. I'm hopeful that people in that position will put politics to the side. Unfortunately, I could spend 3 hours on your show going through all attorneys general that have been in that position and were accused of being political. So
indeed,
it is what it is, but may we please, and to the caller who served our country, we appreciate his service. This is a place where we have to put politics to the side, stop with all the rhetoric about guilty before proven innocent, let the process play out, but do it with a realization that in the country we live in today, appearances matter.
Yeah.
Perceptions matter, and I think that's what fanned the flames this week.
Just about less than 90 seconds left. Fernand, respond to Adam and how, you know, he in your characterization of calling the former president a criminal.
Well, I mean, I think to Adam's point, the civility and the need for getting past this toxic partisanship would have been wonderful if the former president himself had engaged in that behavior as president when he did the exact opposite. In fact, led the divisions, led the creation of these feelings of animosity by attacking groups and individuals and people by name. By the way, let me just remind everyone that the search was executed through a legal process where a federal judge had to review a series of evidence to sign off on
a federal magistrate. It was Fernando, it was a magistrate, not a judge.
Forgive me, a federal magistrate. It was also signed off by the head of the Justice Department and the Attorney General himself. And again, if there were any excesses, that's what institutions and American institutions are for. There will be a process to hold others accountable. But I remind everybody, on the day that this search was being executed, the former president was pleading the fifth 440 times in another civil disposition, recalling his famous quote that, "Why would you plead the fifth unless you were guilty?" That's what the mob does. So again, I don't think we're talking about good faith partisan former presidents here. We're talking about someone who has been impeached twice and has the eye of suspicion and has several open investigations against him, including members of his former party and the January 6th committee.
And just as a point of fact, Fernand, I think it was the day after the FBI search where the president made his declaration of his Fifth Amendment rights as he was being questioned. Fernand Amandi, the Democratic strategist in South Florida. Adam Goodman, Republican strategist in Tampa. Thanks for your time and sharing it with us here on the Florida Roundup. We'll be back on Florida Public Radio.
Support for the Florida Roundup comes from ABC Fine Wine and Spirits, family-owned and operated since 1936. Guests can visit 125 stores throughout Florida or shop online at abcfws.com.
Welcome back to the Florida Roundup here on Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. Well, the cost to rent a home in Florida has been rising faster than almost anywhere else in the nation. Rents across the state in Miami, Jacksonville, Tampa, Orlando, they are up almost 30% in just the last year. We want to know, Florida, how are you dealing with those skyrocketing rents? And if you're a landlord, what are you doing about it? And are you being stretched? Call us 305-995-1800. Tweet us at Florida Roundup.
Now, Orange County voters will decide if some rent increases should be limited to the rate of inflation for a year. The county commission there voted 4-3 this week to put that referendum on the November ballot. WMFE's Joe Byrne has the details.
If voters approve the referendum, rent stabilization would start in late November and last for 1 year. It would apply only to multifamily properties with at least 4 units, and there are other exemptions too. In the end, fewer than half of Orange County's 230,000 rental units would be affected. Dozens of people spoke for and against the measure. Real estate broker Deidre Graybill says the real problem is a lack of housing, and this would be counterproductive.
It's a clear sign to housing providers and other members of the real estate industry that Orange County is closed for business. We're not open to do business.
But Commissioner Emily Bonilla says residents whose rents have increased by 20 to 30% need help now.
Our residents are bleeding monetarily, and we have to stop the bleeding by doing this rent stabilization. We have to stabilize them. That's the first thing you do.
Mayor Jerry Demings voted no, focusing instead on the county's ongoing efforts, including rental assistance, affordable housing, and plans for a tenant bill of rights. In Central Florida, I'm Joe Burns.
In the end, the measure passed 4-3. Orange County Commissioner Myra Uribe voted to put the question on the ballot this fall. Commissioner Uribe, thanks for joining the Florida Roundup. So you voted yes on this initiative. Why?
Because I really feel that we have a lot going on between the market, between the lack of responsiveness on the government side for development, and then the high rising cost of everything. And I did this as a measure to kind of try to slow things down so we could try to get a better plan to improve the livelihood of the residents that live in Orange County.
Do you think it'll pass, this referendum? Will Orange County voters vote it in?
I think it will. Because it's not rent control. I know a lot of people have tried to change the subject line from rental ordinance to rent control. But what this is a rental ordinance that gives a 1 year temporary extended how high landlords can go. But let me just say that that number is going to be equivalent to the CPI. So we're cognizant of inflation going on, not just for the residents, but the landlords and the business, you know, companies that are going on. We're not ignoring anyone in this decision. We just realize we have a massive problem that there's not a quick fix to.
How serious is the problem in your community in Central Florida?
It is huge. We're very service-oriented, although we have been working hard on getting higher-paying jobs. But minimum wage is $10 in Orange County. I mean, it's in the state of Florida. Those rates are not keeping up with how high 25, 30, even 50% rental increases. But at the same time, Orange County is not helping produce enough units. In 2021, they only produced 8,000 units with over 50,000 people moving to Central Florida. There's a huge disconnect, and everyone says supply and demand, and that's the problem. We have a huge demand, not enough supply, and it's causing a gouging in our rental system right now.
Let's say that this effort passes. The voters approve a measure to cap rent in Central Florida. What are your thoughts about state lawmakers overturning that, saying that they could use their power in Tallahassee to prevent what they would perceive as rent control, which is discouraged, if not illegal, in the state of Florida?
Well, I can't agree with the rent control, because rent control is basically saying we're going to put 8-10% cap, and that's all you can do forever. We're making it comparable to the CPI. We're giving, if a has higher prices, I mean, if you had to switch a new roof on yours or something, you know, enormous that caused a greater impact financially on the owner or landlord, we're allowing for exceptions. What we're saying is a one-year ordinance to help get Orange County government on the ball, to develop a system that is proactive, to improve and streamline the developmental process so we can create more than 8,000 units here in a year. And that's really my imposing on it is the problem has taken place for 30 years. And now we're dealt with trying to solve a 30-year-old problem. Mm-hmm. I also believe there's a direct correlation between transportation and housing. At the same time that this measure is going to be in the ballot, so is the transportation tax. So we're talking about an overall injection of some funding that could help improve the livelihood of everyone that lives in Central Florida. But if we don't take a breather, if we don't get the legislators at the table, if we don't get Congress at the table, local elected officials and the community to help solve this issue, including those developers and landlords, we're going to continue to see this, and we're going to continue to see the homelessness and the lack of ability of families to live in this community get worse.
Do you think local officials like yourself are having to step up and address this? Because it sounds by the tone of your comment there, you perceive that state and federal officials aren't doing enough?
I perceive that this problem didn't happen overnight. I don't want to put blame on anyone specifically, but someone has to address it. Do I prefer that we could have had other measures that could have helped, other funding that could have given some additional relief on what we're going to present? Starting very soon, we're going to have some rental relief at the same time to coincide with this. But the bottom line is it didn't happen overnight. It's been decades, but we haven't really dealt with it straight on. And this measure is forcing us to deal with it, because in 1 year, we have to have some solutions in place that are going to improve the rental system.
Orange County Commissioner Myra Uribe, thanks for joining the Florida Roundup.
Thank you for the opportunity. Have a great day.
You're listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. Let's hear from Brian in Orlando. Go ahead, Brian. You're on the radio.
Hey, good afternoon. I was calling just to say that I believe we can do both. We can.
Oh, Brian, you cut off there for us. Sorry about that. Let's see, if you're back with us. He is not. Go ahead, Brian. You're dropping out, so I want to make your point so we can all hear it quickly.
Okay, my apologies. I was from Orlando. I want to say that I believe that we can do both. We can implement a cease on rent increases and also work on the long-term solution. Here in Central Florida, I live on a street with 30 houses, seven of which went on sale in the past year, and five of which were bought by major corporations or large real estate firms, and all rents were increased by almost 40% of what they were previously listed for. So I see that as a major issue as well, along with the...
Brian's Bluetooth there keeps clipping out on us, unfortunately. But Nicole Wilson is with us now, commissioner in Orange County. Commissioner Wilson, thanks for your time. What about the corporate influence as large investors have rediscovered Florida real estate and have been buying up not only single family homes, but also lots of apartment buildings?
Yeah, well, you know, thank you so much for having me and for addressing this issue. I know that Central Florida isn't the only part of Florida that's suffering right now. And, you know, I think the question you're asking is the one that sadly we started asking months and months ago. And by the time we had to make a really big choice about what to put on the ballot, we didn't really have the answer about how much profiteering was truly taking place. We did get overwhelming, obviously, input from our residents that saw, you know, jumps of $600, $800, $1,200 in the last year. And so, you know, having the front hand knowledge of the sort of the residents that are in crisis, and then on the back end, not having any really good data about the profiteering and what that means, we really are just treating the symptoms right now in more than one way.
Commissioner, we have less than 2 minutes left, but what will be different 1 year from now for Orange County renters?
Well, I don't want anyone to hang their hat on this ordinance. It's going on the ballot. It may not pass. Mm-hmm. But in the meantime, we also passed a rent notice so people have time to negotiate. We are trying really hard to get as much of our funding that is designated for housing into people's pockets to be able to pay off their back rent. So hopefully that notice will also help. I also believe getting some of the zoning limitations, you know, really streamlined so we can get projects that need to be, you know, incentivized and moved through for good housing infrastructure inside of our urban service unit where people can move around easily.
Do you believe that if Orange County voters approve this referendum, that it is constitutional under Florida law?
I do. I absolutely do. Every one of the requirements based on the statute that was put in, that were put into place, were contemplated in the ordinance. And that's why it's a very limited ordinance. It can only be in place for 1 year or else we put it back on the ballot. Mm-hmm. It's only applicable to rental units that are not within the luxury range. It's only applicable to rental units of four or more. There's many, many exemptions the Florida statute required us to put in, and that required us to show that there was a housing emergency, a crisis. Gotcha. And we have overwhelming evidence of that based on our social services right here in the county.
We will be watching in the months ahead. Orange County Commissioner Nicole Wilson. Thank you, Commissioner, for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
And thanks for listening to the Florida Roundup, produced by WJCT Public Media in Jacksonville, WLRN Public Media in Miami, with Heather Schatz, Natu Twe, and Catherine Hobbs helping out to produce.
WLRN's Director of Radio Operations, the program's Technical Director, is Peter Mayers. Engineering help from Doug Peterson, Charles Michaels, and Josh Torres. Richard Ives answers the phones. Theme music by Miami jazz guitarist Aaron Libos at AaronLibos.com. I'm Tom Hudson.
And I'm Melissa Ross. We'll be back next Friday. Have a great weekend.
Support for the Florida Roundup comes from ABC Fine Wine and Spirits, family-owned and operated since 1936. Guests can shop any of ABC's 125 Florida stores and get curbside service through abcfws.com.
In HD1, Miami, Fort Lauderdale, 91.5 WKWM and HD1, Marathon, Key West, 105.5 WOLL HD2, Hope Sound, and 101.9 NPR for the Palm Beaches.
The 27th International Ballet Festival of Miami presents the Grand Classical Galas of Ballet Stars, August 13th at the Arch Center and August 14th at Miami-Dade County Auditorium. Tickets and information available at internationalballetfestival.org.
Hi, I'm Michael Stott.
Hi, I'm Karen Neal.
We host The Public Storyteller.
Every Sunday at 4 o'clock, we want to hear stories from you.
Stories that take place in South Florida.
And then I made the connection. In Jamaica, a biscuit is what is called a cookie in America. And what she called a biscuit, we have no equivalent there.
Check out our website at thepublicstoryteller.org.
Tune in Sunday at 4 for The Public Storyteller.
Everyone has a favorite author, actor, musician, or comedian. At All Things Considered, we don't just bring you the news of the day. We introduce you to the coolest people you thought you knew and learn what really makes them tick. What you hear might just surprise you. Join us every afternoon for All Things Considered from NPR News, conversations that connect.
The time is now 1 p.m., 91.3 WLRN.